And I don't think you'll have to lean in for Ron when he speaks, for he can let it rip.
Thank you, Bud. I'm delighted to be here this afternoon, and following Shirley Povich was a real thrill for me because we were friends for a long, long time. And it's probably as close as I'll ever get to the Hall of Fame. Unless they open a wing for Jack Daniels drinkers. And then I'll be in by acclamation. When I was broadcasting the Senators games, I had the best job I've ever had in my life or ever will have. But I have to admit that I got a little bit punchy describing all the losses. So much so, in fact, that I once described a sharp grounder to third as a Harpley shit ground ball.
Ron, we are in a church.
What about Roger Peckinpah?
Shirley mentioned earlier that when he was in the various press rooms, he passed up on the food so he wouldn't be obligated to the various baseball clubs, Shirley. I want you to know, Shirley, that what you passed up, I ate. One story that I've never told before, and it involved Shirley. When I was in line for the Senators broadcasting job, I was very much interested in getting as much ammunition as I could possibly get. So I asked Shirley to put in a good word for me with Bob Short. As it turned out, he did, and I wound up getting the job. But the 3 years went by so swiftly. He had so many great memories of his magnificent years as a baseball writer. The highlight of my career was broadcasting a 300-pound woman from St. Elizabeth's stripping at home plate. We had a great ball club as far as guys are concerned. We didn't win a whole lot of games, but we had a marvelous group of people. Frank Howard was the dominant factor on the ball clubs that I was involved with in 69, 70, and 71. And I remember Ted Williams talking about Frank. He said until he had seen Frank Howard hit a ball, he thought that Jimmy Fox hit the ball further than anyone else he had ever seen. But he said he gave that honor to Frank Howard. I can remember some of the home runs that Hondo hit. They were line drives that literally exploded off the bat and looked like they're going to put a hole in the wall. He just had marvelous power, and he was a great guy to go along with him. He was one of the most outspoken when it was announced the Senators were going to leave Washington for Arlington, Texas. He was a very loyal individual, always has been, and he was really the heart of the Senators ball club. It was an experience that I will never forget, because in those days, you normally traveled by charter plane. Today, they have dropped that in many instances. But I think traveling by charter really made the job of broadcasting a lot easier, because when the game was over, normally the plane would be waiting for you to take you to the next site. And it certainly beats waiting in airports for hours and hours on end. But I thought this afternoon, rather than talk in a defined area, I would open it up for questions that any of you might have about my experiences broadcasting the Senators game. Yes, sir.
Ron, a night game in Yankee Stadium, Frank Howard hit a ball down the foul line that either was fair or foul and either went over the roof or didn't, because no one could really see it. Were you there that night?
What year was it?
I don't know. It was one of those 3 years.
Well, he was with the Senators before I actually did the broadcast of the games. I don't recall that particular play.
I was listening to that game, and it was 1970. It was ruled a foul ball, but it
was 70. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Ron, you were there when Ted Williams.
Well, I think that Ted Williams, when he first came in, did a tremendous job. I think he was very enthusiastic about the job, and he put an awful lot into it. And the first year, as you'll recall, was 1969, and everything seemed to fall in place for the Senators. Whatever move Ted made was the right one. He would substitute Bernie Allen for Tim Cullen in the left-right situation, and whoever was replaced, the guy that replaced him got the key hit in the ball game. And it was as close as the Senators came to finishing in the first division since 1946, which was the last year that they reached that that spot. They talk about lack of support in Washington over the years, but when you consider that the Senators' last pennant was 1933, and the last time they were in the first division was 1946, it gives you some indication of how loyal the Senators fans were over those many, many years. Some fans went out to the ballpark never remembering when their team finished in the first division, much less winning a pennant. So I think they gave admirable support to a team that really didn't measure up on the field in most instances to the other clubs in the league.
Ryan,
yes, Bill.
Kenny McLean in his autobiography goes out of his way to sharply criticize Williams in the year, or a portion of the year that McLean pitched under Williams. And McLean, although he's not hardly an admirable guy, he doesn't do that to any other individual except Mickey Williams. Was there a great rift between them, and why? Why did he
pick
Ted Williams so
much? I think one reason is that Denny was a rabble-rouser, quite frankly. And he liked to stir up trouble, and he did. And he was a very colorful guy who was likable enough. I mean, he had a lot of friends on the ball club. He went out drinking with them and so forth. But Williams was a stickler for discipline. And I think he realized that with McLean, he was trying to subvert everything that he tried to establish on the field. And I think that's the reason for the animosity. Yes, Jerry.
Do you have any good Jim French or Eddie Brinkman stories?
Well, the only Jim French story that I can think of offhand is, I can think of two. When the Senators left Washington in 1971, I asked Teddy Baxter, who was the equipment manager, for the Senators jacket, which he was kind enough to give me. It happened to be Jim French's Senators jacket. And I reached in the pocket, and there was a church key inside. The other story, we were in Kansas City, and Jim French used to stay right up to date with the latest fashions, whereas Ted Williams, of course, would get great mileage out of one shirt and one pair of pants, and it would last the whole road trip. And Williams had made some comments about Frenchie's attire one night, and he turned to him and said, "Well, it sure beats a million milers you're wearing, Ted." Yes, Bill.
Ron, people think Ted Williams is the one Hall of Famer with the club for those years. But in the next few years, I think we'll see a member of the coaching staff on that team probably go in the Hall of Fame, how you were close to Nellie Fox. What kind of guy was Fox?
He was a terrific guy. Nellie hated to fly. And, of course, in our era, we flew all the time. We did fly charters, which made it a little bit better. In fact, a lot better. But he always used to have the Crown Royal in the back, and he would go through three or four of them during the flight. And I also get a kick out of Nellie because he had a Jeep, and he used to live over in the College Park area. And since I was over in that neck of the woods, he would usually take me back home after a road trip. Well, when I would go on a road trip, I would try and find as much baseball memorabilia and books and things like that. And I would pack my suitcases with him. And Nellie swears that I broke the springs of his Jeep coming back from one of the road trips one time. Yes,
Ron,
Paul?
Yeah. I'm sure everybody in the room thinks about this requirement. But do you think, being as close as you were to the team, that either of the departures this summer, was there anything other than a
No, I don't think so. I think when Short bought the ball club, he intended to move the team. I don't think there's any doubt about that. He, our first year, we played an exhibition game in Arlington, Texas. and he already had it in the works to try and move. Now, if the senators had drawn 1.5 million people every year, there's no way he could have gotten away with it. But I think he definitely intended to move the ball club, but of course he did. Yes?
In Michigan, there have been rumors that the McLean-Brinkman-Rodriguez trade had a clause that never became public, namely that Campbell and Fetzer of the Tigers promised Short that they would support any proposed move of the franchise. Can you confirm or deny that?
I can't, but it would not surprise me a bit. I think the Denny McLean trade was probably the worst trade that was ever made by the Senators' ball club. I can remember when it happened. I was at the Ocean, and it was between the playoffs and the World Series, and the World Series that year happened to be in Baltimore. And when the word got out that the deal had been consummated, a lot of the Orioles were saying, well, that's going to give the pennant to Detroit. And it came very close, and of course the Tigers won the, division title in 72. But the Senators gave up everything for a pitcher who was great at one time. I mean, there's no disputing Denny McLean's greatness, but when he came to the Senators, he had a sore arm. He couldn't perform up to his past abilities, and as a result, they got damaged goods, and they just never compensated for the loss. They gave up Joe Coleman. They gave up Eddie Brinkman. Rodriguez was in the deal. I mean, it was just a crushing blow, and actually, I maintain that one of the mistakes Williams made was not going to the meetings with Bob Short. He was down in Florida fishing, and he had the option on any deal that Short made to approve or disapprove. But by the time Ted got the word, it was a finished deal, and as a result, it was a thing that I think single-handedly cost the Senators the franchise. Yes, sir. You had a question before.
Well, I think the terms on which Short bought the team, it put him in a situation similar to, although I don't think it was their intent, the people that bought the Braves, where there was no way that they could earn enough money from operations to make the payments required to fill their end of the deal. And the only way that in both cases that they could do it was to make the move.
I think that's quite true. Short really did not put up that much in the way of cash. He was cash poor when he bought the ball club. He was able to circumvent that, and the deal was approved by the other owners in the American League. Of course, when the vote came, I think it was 10-2 in favor of the franchise move. I'll never forget the last night because it was such a memorable thing. I guess that's probably the greatest thrill I ever had in sports broadcasting, describing Frank Howard's home run, which literally turned an entire game around. I don't know how many of you were there that night. I guess by the time history unfolds 50 years from now, there'll be 200,000 people who said they were at the game. But the announced attendance was 14,000, but I think there are probably 25 or 30,000 people actually in the stadium. The ushers just let come in free. But Short was not at the game that night. And as the game was progressing, I was talking about Washington baseball and how I thought it was a crime. They were losing a franchise. And considering everything, the club had been admirably supported over the years. And Short always had a setup in his home where he could listen to broadcasts, even though he lived out in Edina, Minnesota. So as my comments started, the phone calls began. And Short was calling, and Bill Sanders, who was general manager of WWDC, the flagship station, was in the booth. And Short was basically imploring Bill, making stop. And I said, what in the hell is he going to do, fire me? Yes, sir.
I heard Short came back to the National Press Club for the draft.
I think he did.
And I'll never forget that because his reason for trading the club was so ludicrous that he started laughing, and everybody just laughed at him, including himself. It was a blatant lie. It was just even by Washington standards.
Well, Short made some real lulus. Of course, one of his deals was signing Curt Flood, who was well past his peak when he came back. And I often said that, considering Short's propensity to get headline makers and people who've been in the news that if Adolf Hitler were still alive, he'd be in left field. Yes, sir.
The general manager back then was Ted Williams in Baltimore, so, you know, after you can't do that. Did they have a general manager? Was Ted Williams back?
Well, basically, Williams was general manager, not entitled. Joe Burke was business manager. He handled a lot of the day-to-day affairs. The first year, 1969, Ed Daugherty was the general manager, but Ed was fired after the first season, and then Joe Burke moved in, and Joe handled the business aspects of it, and Ted Williams had a lot of the personnel moves, but Short was ultimately the one who made the decision.
I have another question. I have a couple of things. First thing, I used to hear, I don't know if this is true or not, Baltimore, we heard at the time that Park River had the highest parking prices in both leagues. Is that just something sour grapes, or is that true?
No, I think it was true. And as a matter of fact, one of the first things Short did when he came in was raise the ticket prices. And he moved the general admission out into the bleacher area in the second deck in the outfield. Yes, sir.
Yeah, that leads me to the Is it your impression that Short did things to discourage attendance? Because it certainly was my impression.
Well, he certainly didn't make many friends the decisions he made. Whether he did it purposely, I don't know. I mean, as I say, if 1.5 million people turned up, despite what Short was doing, there's no way on earth he could have moved the club. But I think the attendance was admirable when you consider. Yes, sir, in the back of Green's Weather. Great guy. Well, I'll give you an example on Frank Howard. He was the type of individual who never let the big salary go to his head. He was the first senator, I guess, to make $100,000 a year, which would be a utility infielder today. He was the type of guy who would, at the end of the season, when they would call up all the minor leaguers, he would take them all out to dinner and just give them a taste of life in the big leagues. I can't imagine too many of the superstars of the day, Eddie Murray, for example, or Captain Surly taking somebody out. Yes, Bill?
Well, I just think it's important to point out, the 1969, the 69 Senators had the same ticket prices as the 1980 Dodgers.
Wow.
And in the 1971 program, there was no season ticket information. So a little subliminal. But
No, that's a very good point. I know the ticket prices were very, very high.
Right.
And that's the first thing he did when he came in. And in addition to that, he took the general admission seats, which were normally along the sides of the field, and put them way out in the right and left and center field bleachers. So you were a long, long way from home in the general admission seat. Yes, sir.
Can you probably answer this question before, but what did you think of the book, Kiss It Goodbye?
I enjoyed it. Shelby Whitfield is an old friend of mine. In fact, he called me last Thursday. We chatted for quite a while about the old days. I think basically what Shelby said in there was true. I think any author who writes a book is going to write a self-serving book, and I think he did to a degree. But the difference between Shelby and myself, Shelby worked for the ball club. He was an employee of the club. I was an employee of the radio station. And I think what Short did to Shelby was pathetic, because he not only had to do the games at night, which is a job in itself, and you have to be alert all the time, but he had Shelby coming in at 9 o'clock in the morning, working in the office all day long, and then broadcasting a game at night. And Short was the type of individual who loved to humiliate people publicly. I can't find fault with a boss who has something to say to somebody that he's not pleased with their work or whatever. But to me, it should be done in private. Short always criticized people publicly by hollering at them and trying to make a fool out of them while there was an audience around. To me, it just showed what a small individual he was. Yes, sir?
I understand that Short was also a person most responsible for the Lakers.
Yeah. That was pointed out when he first came to Washington. And, of course, he denied it vehemently. Oh, no, I have no intention of doing this, but in reality, I think he opted immediately for the move to Texas when he came in. As I say, the only thing would have changed it would have been phenomenal attendance. And with all the circumstances, the high admission prices, the bad seating, the stadium being in the location it was in a rough neighborhood, all of these were factors that really were against the outstanding attendance. Yes?
I've heard a rumor that you used to play tapes of crowd noises.
No. No, that never happened, unless they did back at the station that I was not aware of. But no, as far as I know, that was not done. Yes, sir?
What were the financial advantages to Short in moving to Texas, apart from the obvious one of greater attendance on a part of the new franchise and so forth? Were there,
well, he had a radio TV contract down there that really brought him a bonanza, and it was paid over an extended period of time, I think something like 10 or 15 years. Is that right, Bill?
Yeah, it was. He got 10 years worth of broadcast rights up front, $7.5 million, which he was able to keep even if he sold the club the next day, which essentially he did. So I seem to recall a column that Merrill Whittleson wrote that Short actually was going to try and move the team at mid-season 71. And Wick found out about it and wrote the story.
Put the kibosh on it.
After the All-Star break.
I would not be surprised at all if that was not his intention. I know that when the announcement came out, it seems to me it was around the 1st of September, but I remember it didn't come like the last week of the season. It came well before the season was over.
Okay. One more, is that it?
Yes.
Okay, the last one.
He died about, 5 or 6 years ago? Oh, well, he ultimately sold the Texas Rangers, made a financial killing on it. He owned the Lemington Hotel in Minneapolis, and I think when he died, he still owned the hotel. What other businesses he had?
He ran for the Senate.
Yeah, didn't somebody
he ran for the Senate.
Baseball Bill.
Oh, yeah. Baseball Bill went out to campaign against him. He's the same one who poured beer on him in Baltimore.
I was just going to say, I was there that night. The cops came down. We were sitting in the front row right for the fun of the dugout. We were sitting there. And
I've seen the picture in the paper with a beer dripping down. It was a great shot. The only thing I regret, it wasn't me who poured it.
That was Ron Mancini, M-A-N-C-H-I-N-E, broadcast Washington games 1969 to 71.
Disruption when I had to walk out, I had to get to Jack Daniels.